This is the sixth and final lecture in the series Wealth, Natural Resources, and the Environment, and the Political Concept of Monopoly.
As I explained on Tuesday, monopoly, according to the political concept, is a market or part of a market reserved to the exclusive possession of one or more sellers by means of the initiation of physical force, by or with the sanction of the government. Tuesday, I covered the case of exclusive government franchises as a leading instance of monopoly. I now turn to other leading cases of monopoly on the political concept, including licensing law monopoly, tariff monopoly, monopoly based on minimum wage and pro-union legislation, government-owned and government-subsidized enterprises, the antitrust laws, and socialism. I will also deal with some further leading implications of the political concept of monopoly, namely the fact that monopoly can represent the protection of the inefficient many against the more efficient few, or even just one. The fact that monopoly prices often reflect unnecessarily high costs rather than high profits. And the fact that patents and copyrights and trademarks and brand names do not represent monopoly, but are actually an aspect of the freedom of competition. Licensing laws create monopolies by virtue of initiating physical force to reserve markets to the exclusive possession of the license holders. Examples of monopoly based on licensing laws are the occupations of accountant, barber, beautician, contractor, dentist, lawyer, liquor store owner, optician, pharmacist, physician, teacher, and taxi cab driver. Only the holders of the licenses are legally allowed to pursue the field in question. All others are excluded by means of the initiation of force. Of course, licensing laws are defended on the grounds that they are necessary to public health or safety or some other such high purpose. But the fact is, they keep out of fields suppliers who would otherwise be in them, suppliers with whom the public would be glad to deal voluntarily without any form of force or fraud being present. Their effect is always to deprive the buyers of services they could have had, to raise the price of the services they are allowed to receive, to elevate the incomes of the license holders, and to depress the incomes of those who are excluded from the licensed fields. It may well be the case that licensing does serve, as its supporters often claim, to raise the minimum level of competence and expertise in a field, and thus to guarantee to the buyers a higher level of service than they would have received in its absence. But even if this were true, it would not by any means be an advantage to the buyers. It would merely mean, it means in many cases, that buyers are forced to buy a higher quality level of service than they want or need. And if they cannot afford the higher quality level of service, are forced to do without the service they could have had. The result on this score is comparable in essence to a law that would require that the minimum quality of automobiles on the road be no less than, say, a 5-year-old Chevrolet of average quality. While such a law would undoubtedly raise the average quality level of the cars that remained on the road, it would also operate to prevent many people from driving, namely those who could not afford anything beyond the quality of cars they presently drive, and that are below the quality of the average 5-year-old Chevrolet. In just this way, medical licensing, the field in which licensing might be thought to be more urgent and necessary than any other, has the paradoxical effect of depriving the poor of medical care altogether. In the absence of medical licensing, it would not be the case that barbers and butchers would be able to compete as doctors any more than they can compete in the automobile or steel industry. Competition would establish educational performance and other requirements. And it would still be fraud to claim a degree or any other form of private certification that one did not have. The new competition would come from people who today must be content to be registered nurses, pharmacists, biologists, and so forth, but who could become qualified to practice important aspects of medicine presently monopolized by the licensed physicians, and to do so with a high degree of competence. These people are present in the ranks of those arbitrarily rejected by today's monopolistically restricted medical schools, or who are deterred from even trying for admission to today's medical schools. They would be able to provide medical care to many who today cannot afford medical care. And even if the medical care they provided was less complete than that provided by most of today's practitioners, it would certainly still be far superior to no medical care at all. Moreover, in serious cases beyond their competence, they could make referrals to doctors of greater expertise than themselves. In necessary cases, the poor would be better able to afford the services even of the more qualified doctors, since they too would be rendered less expensive by the new competition. For many people who had had to use the more qualified doctors would also turn to the new less expensive competitors whenever possible. This would operate both to reduce the price of the more qualified doctors' services, bringing them more within reach of the poor, and to make their time more available to the poor, since it would no longer be in as great demand by the middle class and the wealthy. Just think of it, you all know people from your college days who wanted to go to medical school, who couldn't get in, who have now disappeared into God knows what fields. And then there are other people, patients clamoring for the lack of care, and the government stands between these two parties getting together. In many cases, licensing actually serves no legitimate purpose whatever. It is nothing more than a pretext for imposing arbitrary requirements on prospective suppliers, its only real purpose being to keep the supply down and the price up. Requiring barbers and beauticians, for example, to take year-long courses on dermatology can have no other purpose but to discourage people from becoming barbers or beauticians, and thus to keep up the price of the services of those who do become barbers or beauticians. Whereas in medicine and even in home building, there is a legitimate purpose in licensing, that purpose can be achieved without licensing. People want to know with whom they are dealing. That is why they attach so much importance to brand names and why customer goodwill is so important. In dealing with doctors and home builders, especially if they could not take for granted the approval of an allegedly all-wise, all-knowing government bestowed through conferral of a license, people would insist on an established reputation or on strong endorsements from those with established reputations and whose judgment they trusted. And insurers and lenders, of course, could impose their own additional requirements, which would be particularly important in the case of home building. Indeed, it is even possible to imagine that the very same employees of the present medical licensing boards and the very same building inspectors who now work for the government would stay on as employees of private certification agencies and continue to perform all the legitimate substance of the work they presently perform. There would be one essential difference, however, that would constitute a fundamental and major improvement. That would be that no one would be compelled to accept the judgment of government officials or of any other group of people. With private certification, not only would the supply of a service be greater and the price correspondingly lower, but no less important, there would be permanently more chances for new ideas being tried, and thus improvements would come far more rapidly than is possible today. Under private certification, not only would there almost certainly be more than one certification agency in any given occupation, but the individual would always have the right to step outside the system and decide entirely for himself. It would not be necessary, as is now the case, that before trying a new cure for a disease or a new method of constructing a building, a person would have to wait upon the pleasure of any group of government officials to approve it. If, to take a particularly outrageous example, a person has heart disease or has suffered a stroke, he could freely buy medications whose effectiveness has already long since been proved in Western Europe, to the satisfaction of large numbers of doctors. Neither he nor his physician would have to fear the licensing power either of a state board of medical quality assurance or of the federal government's Food and Drug Administration. If an individual is dying of cancer and cannot be cured by methods endorsed by the present medical establishment, he could freely accept the responsibility of turning to something different. It's no doubt true that under the freedom of competition, some individuals would act irresponsibly and at the first opportunity turn to quacks. The existence of such people, however, is no reason for denying freedom to everyone else who would use it to great advantage. Moreover, under freedom, stupidity of choice serves as its own punishment, and therefore tends to diminish the amount of it. If the misuse of freedom by the ignorant and the foolish is what is feared, then a better case can be made for the licensing of politicians and government officials than of medicine or any other regular profession or trade. For here, when people turn to charlatans, the consequences are suffered by all. But of course, there can be no such thing as the licensing of politicians and government officials, for who would license them but other politicians and government officials? And what could be more dangerous than to allow politicians and government officials to have such power? The existence of freedom, it is true, carries with it the possibility that people will make wrong and even foolish choices, but there is no alternative. That possibility exists with or without freedom. The great advantage of freedom is that each individual has the right to make his own choices and need not be bound by the ignorance or stupidity of others. The alternative to freedom is settling matters by force. And here, the ignorant and stupid have the greatest chance to control the outcome and to compel all to go with them, for force represents the area of their comparative advantage. The premise of a free country is that the citizens are intelligent enough to run their own affairs and, in their time left over from their own affairs, the affairs of their government as well. Citizens who are not qualified to pass on the qualifications of their doctor or building contractor, or on the qualifications of the experts whose advice they accept in these areas, are even less qualified to pass on matters of foreign policy or domestic policy. This is certainly not a plea to deprive such citizens of the right to vote, for the reasons just explained, though it is certainly a good basis, a good argument for limiting the questions that people have the power to decide by vote. That is, it is a good argument for limited government. What I am saying is making a plea that people retain and enlarge their freedom of choice in the economic area, and by the natural method of gaining from their right choices and suffering from their wrong choices, be led to make all of their decisions as conscientiously and as wisely as they can. Before leaving the subject of licensing monopoly, I want to observe that probably far more important than breaking the licensing monopoly presently enjoyed by physicians would be breaking the licensing monopoly presently enjoyed by hospitals. People justly complain of the enormous costs of hospital stays. These costs could be radically reduced by allowing the freedom of competition in hospital care. The cost of hospital stays to patients is enormously higher in many cases than corresponds to the actual costs of providing the services. $800 to $1,000 a day for a hospital stay is often, and I would think typically, far out of line with the hospital's own costs that are necessary to provide the service, together with allowance for a competitive rate of profit. Under the freedom of competition, physicians and profit-seeking hospital administrators would be free to cash in on the high profits that could be made by opening their own hospitals. They would be free to concentrate on offering the presently most profitable types of care. The effect would be a decline in the cost of such hospital stays to a point corresponding to the actual costs of providing them, together with an allowance for a competitive rate of profit. At the same time, the freedom of competition would permit hospitals to cut their costs of operation and thus to bring rates down to levels reflecting still lower levels of actual costs. Today, there is a great deal of justified outrage over the enormous and ever-increasing cost of medical care. And in response, people assert a right to medical care. But their idea of a right to medical care is a right consistent with the anarchic concept of freedom. That is, an alleged right which is to be implemented without regard to the willingness of others to cooperate. The government is to take money from the taxpayers at the point of a gun to implement this alleged right to medical care, and it is to hold a gun to the heads of physicians and hospitals to make them supply medical care on the terms and by the methods it imposes. This is a total corruption of the concept of rights. It is, as Ayn Rand would describe it, an assertion of an alleged right to enslave. What needs to be done to solve the medical crisis is to understand the concept of the right to medical care consistently with the rational concept of freedom and the political concept of monopoly. The right to medical care rationally means the right to all the medical care one can afford to buy and chooses to buy from any willing provider. The medical crisis exists because the medical crisis exists because of a repeated pattern of violation of the right to medical care properly understood. Individuals want to buy medical services from willing providers whom the government excludes from the medical professions by licensing laws. It violates the right of these individuals to buy and of these providers to sell medical care. Thus, the government monopolizes the medical profession on behalf of its license holders. This makes medical care scarcer and more expensive. The government practices the same policy of exclusion and monopolization in the case of hospitals, again making medical care scarcer and more expensive. The government does exactly the same thing in the case of medications through the Food and Drug Administration, which creates a systematic monopoly of the drugs it approves by forcibly excluding from the market all other drugs. The violations of freedom and individual rights practiced by the government in the pursuit of its policy of medical monopoly are powerfully reinforced by its policy of violating freedom and individual rights in forcing some citizens to pay for the medical care of others. In the face of pervasive monopoly, the policy of pouring ever more taxpayer money into medicine simply represents steadily enlarging the demand in the face of an artificially restricted supply, with the inevitable result that prices continually rise. This process is further compounded, powerfully compounded, by the fact that medical care is made free to large numbers of recipients, who then have no reason to limit the amount of it they use, which of course leads to correspondingly large government expenditures to pay for it, and to higher rates for paying patients to whom a substantial part of the burden is shifted. The solution to the medical crisis is not the implementation of a vicious alleged right to medical care, whose actual meaning is a right to enslave, but the implementation of the rational right to medical care. That is, to end the government's policy of medical monopoly, and of course, its policy of forcing some citizens to pay the medical bills of others. It is to make the government recognize the citizen's actual right, his rational right, to obtain medical care from any willing provider, and thus to stop the government's forcible exclusion of willing providers from the market. I turn now to protective tariffs as an important example of monopoly according to the political concept. Protective tariffs represent the use of force to make foreign producers sell their goods at a higher price or less profitably than domestic producers. As such, they represent legislation on behalf of monopoly in that they attempt to reserve the market or a larger portion of the market to the exclusive possession of domestic producers. Protective tariffs, along with licensing laws, highlight the fact that monopoly, according to the political concept, is not limited to the case of sole producers protected by the initiation of force. It applies equally to cases of very large numbers of producers whose market is protected by the initiation of physical force. A tariff monopoly can serve to protect tens of thousands of small, inefficient domestic producers against foreign competition. For example, a protective tariff on wheat in France has the effect of giving a monopoly of the French wheat market, or of a larger share of that market, to French wheat growers. The monopoly of these producers is no less a monopoly merely because of their large number. The market, or their part of the market, is reserved to them by means of the initiation of force. More efficient foreign producers are correspondingly denied the freedom of competition. Both tariffs and licensing laws make possible monopolies shared by large numbers of inefficient, high-cost producers. Such monopolies are no less monopolies when the more efficient, lower-cost producers who are forcibly kept out are small in number, even when there is only just one very large, more efficient, lower-cost producer who would otherwise gain the market that is presently monopolized. The New York City taxicab industry, I believe, provides an example of the monopolistic protection of the inefficient many against the competition of the more efficient few. The number of taxicabs in New York City that can cruise the streets for hire has been forcibly limited since 1938 at a number slightly below 12,000. Since that time, it has been a legal precondition of operating such a taxi that one possess a small metal medallion issued by the city government of New York and affixed to the hood of the cab. To operate a taxi cab, one must not only know how to drive and be able to afford to buy a cab, one must possess a further item as well, the precious medallion, which signifies the government's permission that one can do what one can already do. Thank you. If one does not possess this medallion, this fifth wheel of taxi driving in terms of its actual physical relationship to the ability to operate a cab, one is in violation of the law and subject to arrest. In this way, the city government of New York reserves the market for cruising taxicabs to the exclusive possession of its license holders and excludes all others by the initiation of force. These medallions, it should be noted, now sell for a price well in excess of $100,000 each. That price is the measure of the additional annual income that is to be made by virtue of operating a taxi cab at the higher level of rates caused by the licensing requirement and the consequent artificial scarcity of cabs. If the licensing requirement for taxi cabs were abolished, more cabs would cruise the streets and their competition would drive rates down. In the face of lower rates and the elimination of the extra income presently conferred by the possession of a medallion, the pressure to reduce the costs of operating a taxi cab would intensify. This would strongly favor fleet operation over individual operation. It would mean the replacement of thousands of very small, relatively inefficient cab companies consisting of a single cab and owner-driver, by a relatively small number of much larger, more efficient taxi cab companies operating a substantial fleets of cabs. The fleets would enjoy such competitive advantages as the ability to keep their cabs on the road for three successive shifts a day, 7 days a week, and the presence of resident mechanics to minimize downtime for repairs. Such advantages would enable them to gain vastly greater use from each cab in any given year, and not to be put out of operation, as would an owner-driver, by the breakdown of any given cab. The probable effect of fleet competition would be a decline in taxicab rates to the point where it was simply not economically possible to operate a cab as an individual owner-driver. In this way, the freedom of competition would operate in this instance to replace a large number of small, relatively inefficient producers with a relatively small number of large, efficient producers. A phenomenon similar to that of the New York City taxicab industry existed and may still exist in many parts of Europe with respect to the competition of department stores and chain stores. In order to protect large numbers of small merchants from their competition, the establishment of these stores was discouraged or simply prohibited. Here again was a case of monopoly in favor of the inefficient many against the more efficient few. The implication of this discussion is that monopoly exists and the freedom of competition is violated, not because there happens to be just one seller in a market when all have the legal right to enter, but when there are millions of sellers in the market and all but one are allowed to enter, with that one otherwise able and willing to enter. In such a case, the market is reserved to the exclusive possession of all but that one. It is monopolized against him. It is monopolized against him even if his entry were to result in his displacing all of the many who are in the market now and his becoming the sole seller. For example, a monopoly would exist in the automobile market even if it were comprised of thousands of small automobile companies, and even if everyone in the world were allowed to enter it, with the single exception of the original Henry Ford. Such exclusion of Ford would constitute a monopoly in violation of the freedom of competition. It would constitute a monopoly even if Ford's entry were to mean that he would then become the sole seller of automobiles, which fact would not constitute a monopoly so long as everyone retains the legal freedom to enter. In every case, whether a particular monopoly represents the initiation of force to protect the one against the competition of the many, or the many against the competition of the few, or just one, its effect is to protect the less efficient against the more efficient, and to raise the price to the buyers of the good or service in comparison with the price that would exist under the freedom of competition. I turn now to monopoly based on minimum wage and pro-union legislation. Such legislation operates to reserve labor markets to the exclusive possession of the reduced numbers who can be employed at the higher wage rates it establishes. The legislation forcibly excludes from the market the additional numbers who could be employed at the lower wage rates that the freedom of competition would establish. Minimum wage and pro-union legislation also tend to reserve labor markets to the exclusive possession of the more skilled workers by virtue of impairing the ability specifically of the less skilled workers to compete through the acceptance of lower wages. Because of limitations of time and because Professor Williams has already ably covered the essential points that need to be made here, I'll immediately move on to consider a different leading case of monopoly, namely government-owned and government-subsidized enterprises. They also represent monopoly in that markets or parts of markets are reserved to their exclusive possession by means of the initiation of physical force. Government-subsidized enterprises, of course, are a category which includes all government-owned enterprises, inasmuch as the initial resources of government-owned enterprises are provided by the government and their subsequent losses are covered by the government. The funds of all enterprises supported by the government are obtained by means of the initiation of force against the taxpayers, who certainly do not pay taxes voluntarily for such purposes. At the same time, the subsidies make possible those enterprises' possession of markets or parts of markets to which other suppliers are denied access. Competitors of the subsidized enterprises cannot gain their markets, even if they are more efficient and offer better products, because the subsidized enterprises are unable to sell their products at a loss or even to give them away free of charge. Thus, government-subsidized enterprises are monopolies. Their markets are reserved to them on a foundation of the initiation of force against the taxpayers, which then makes possible their ability to retain their markets despite the economic superiority of competitors. The monopoly position of government-owned enterprises and other government-subsidized enterprises can, of course, also be buttressed by the initiation of physical force against parties other than the taxpayers. Above all, the initiation of force directly against competitors or potential competitors. The government-owned United States Postal Service is an example of this phenomenon. Here, in order to limit its losses, the government prohibits important categories of competition, such as the delivery of first-class mail, which apparently would be highly profitable at the present government rates to potential competitors. The government simply declares most of the roads of the United States to be post roads, and then prohibits the carrying of private first-class mail over the post roads. Whoever would carry such mail would be in violation of the law and would face the threat of fines and imprisonment. An even more important example of monopoly than the post office in the category of government-owned or government-subsidized enterprises is the public education system. The total absence of tuition charges at the elementary and secondary school levels and the substantially lower level of tuition charges at the college and university level that tax-financed subsidies make possible enable the public education system to retain the far greater share of the education market despite its clear inferiority in comparison with private schools. As the result of the subsidies the government system receives, and thus its ability to charge prices below cost, indeed no price at all, it is not sufficient that a private school or college simply be perceptibly better in order to induce customers to give it their patronage rather than the public system. To take advantage of the superiority of the private schools, students or their parents must be prepared to pay the full tuition in order to gain what is merely an improvement on what is offered in the public system for nothing or very little. In effect, they are placed in a position in which to choose a private school or college, they must pay the full price for what, from their perspective, is not the full product, but only a qualitative increment in the full product. For they already have such a product from the public system for nothing or very little. In these conditions, before people will switch from the public schools and colleges to the private schools and colleges, they must regard the mere superiority of the private school or college as so great that it justifies paying the whole price of the education. In effect, this requires that to obtain a customer, a private school or college must be able to offer a doubled product for just one tuition. To be competitive with the subsidized public school system, it must, in effect, offer one part of its product equal to what the government provides, for free. It can earn tuition revenue only on the other part of its product, which must be judged of such importance as to justify the payment of the whole tuition. And it must produce this doubled product at no greater cost than the tuition it is able to charge for the mere part of it, the mere qualitative improvement. Indeed, at an even lower cost, to the extent that it wants to have a profit. Now, this is unfair competition. It is unjust, immoral competition. It is competition based on the initiation of force. It is not the competition of a free market, but the practice of monopoly, the excluding of competitors by means of the initiation of force. In the long run, public education does not, as its supporters believe, make it possible for students to obtain education who would not otherwise obtain education. On the contrary, it serves to deny education to students who otherwise would have obtained it. In making it impossible for private schools to be commercially successful, public education prevents all those improvements in quality and efficiency from coming into being that would take place in education under the competitive quest to make profits and avoid losses, and which would eventually bring a much higher quality education within the reach of all than is now available only to the wealthiest. In addition, it precludes any significant competitive barrier to deterioration in the education that it itself, the public school system, offers. Because it is financed by subsidies, public education has the potential to decline in quality all the way to the point where it becomes clear to most people that what it offers is no longer worth even a zero price. Only at that point does private education achieve a decisive competitive advantage in the mass market and threaten the public school system and its bureaucracy with economic extinction. Thus, the consequence of public education is the prevention of improvements in education and ultimately the destruction of such education as exists. For these reasons, its ultimate effect is to deprive people of education who could have obtained it, not to promote education. What public education accomplishes is that education is supplied without the benefit of the incentive of profit and loss in an environment of freedom of competition. If education had to operate in the same basic economic context as the automobile industry or grocery business, a powerful incentive would exist to improve quality and reduce costs, because this would be the way to increase profits. Any school or chain of schools that introduced any perceptible improvement in education would have a substantial increase in its profits. Students and their parents would want to deal with it, not its less efficient competitors. It would be giving them more for their money. Similarly, if it succeeded in cutting its costs and could operate profitably at a lower level of tuition, it would also enjoy a large expansion in business as a larger part of the market came to prefer to deal with it, because its tuition charges were now lower than its competitors. In response to the competitive pressure of the loss of business to the schools which improve their quality and efficiency, all other schools would be compelled to improve their quality and efficiency or else be driven out of business. As the schools in the latter group caught up, it would no longer be possible for the schools that had introduced the improvements to continue to make exceptional profits. To go on making exceptional profits, they would now have to introduce further improvements with the same ultimate results. Thus, the basis would exist for continuous improvements in quality and efficiency for the benefit of the buying public. All of this would be simply the operation of the uniformity of profit principle applied to education, a principle I discuss at great length in The Government Against the Economy. But of course, with public education, there is no incentive of profit and loss. There is nothing to be gained within the system by introducing improvements, nor is there anything to be lost within the system in failing to match the performance of others. A loss of students, whether it results from an improvement in the performance of other schools or from a decline in the performance of one's own school, does not mean a loss out of the school superintendent's pocket or out of the pocket of anyone who sits on the local school board. At the same time, the public school's shield of a zero or minimal tuition charge greatly reduces the volume of any additional business that any private school could obtain by virtue of improving its quality or reducing its costs within the range of what is presently feasible. As matters stand, the potential market for commercially successful private education is confined to an extremely narrow one constituted by the children of the very well-to-do, who can afford to pay the whole price of an education for an incremental improvement. Even this overstates the present market for commercial private education. Commercial private education is seriously hampered by the existence of costly legal requirements mandating such things as a school's provision of a cafeteria, gymnasium, library, and so forth, and limiting its ability to adopt more economical educational methods in still other respects as well. For example, requirements concerning class size, the ratio of full-time faculty to students, the minimum education of faculty, and the number of hours of in-class instruction. Its development is still further hampered by the fact that the present hostile environment fosters the tradition of non-commercial private education, fosters the tradition of non-commercial private education, in which even private education is largely subsidized by wealthy individuals and religious organizations. In this environment, commercial private education is faced with obstacles that may simply be too great for it to overcome. It is greatly limited both in its ability to reduce costs and improve quality, and in the additional market it can gain should it manage, despite all obstacles, somehow to do so. Thus, under present conditions, it is virtually impossible for private commercial education to develop the momentum of progressive improvement that would characterize it under the freedom of competition. Indeed, under present conditions, it is next to impossible for it to attract the kind of talent that would be capable of achieving any significant improvements in the first place. The position of private education today, and that of education as a whole, is analogous to what the position of the automobile industry would be if the production of all the low and medium-priced models were in the hands of the government, which subsidized their production to the point of giving these models away for nothing, indeed, of compelling every adult to accept one for nothing, while the privately owned portion of the automobile industry was confined to the production of the very expensive models and essentially prohibited from cutting its costs. In such circumstances, the only significant force that could operate in favor of the growth of the private automobile industry would be a total collapse in the quality of the government's automobiles. Just so, the only significant factor operating in favor of the growth of private education today is the continuous decline in the quality of public education. In addition to public education and the post office, government ownership of railroad, bus, and subway lines, and enterprises producing electric power, such as the Tennessee Valley Authority, represents cases of monopoly. The market of these enterprises, too, is reserved by the initiation of force against the taxpayers in order to provide subsidies which enable them to sell at prices below those that private competitors must charge. Government-owned roads and highways must also be placed in this category, and in their case, the very possibility of private competition is usually prohibited outright as well. I want to now discuss the antitrust laws as pro-monopoly legislation. However surprising it may seem, the antitrust laws constitute pro-monopoly legislation. They reserve markets or parts of markets to the exclusive possession of all but those who in a state of freedom of competition would occupy them. They monopolize markets precisely against capable and efficient firms, which in their absence would be able to be in those markets, and which instead, because of their existence, are today forcibly excluded from those markets. The antitrust laws prevent the capable newcomer from entering an industry. For example, they would almost certainly operate to prevent General Motors from entering the steel industry in any significant way. They prevent the capable firms within an industry from acquiring the markets of the less capable ones by absorbing them in mergers, by buying them out, or by driving them out. Ironically, while endless complaints are made about such things as high capital requirements and lack of technological knowledge as, quote, barriers to entry, no voices are raised to complain about the antitrust laws' forcible exclusion from markets of precisely those firms which do have the capital and the technological knowledge required to enter them. This is how powerful and ingrained is the influence of the anarchic concept of freedom. In serving forcibly to exclude from markets precisely those firms which have the ability to enter and compete in them, the antitrust laws constitute a major violation of the freedom of entry and the freedom of competition. As such, they are among the most important instances of pro-monopoly legislation. In the last analysis, what has prevented the antitrust laws from being identified as pro-monopoly legislation and has allowed them to be regarded as anti-monopoly legislation instead is the irrationalist mentality underlying the anarchic concept of freedom. This irrationalist mentality places the unreal world of arbitrary desires above the real world of competence and potency. Its concept of the violation of freedom is frustration of the arbitrary desires by the facts of reality. It does not see as a violation of freedom the frustration of competence and potency by the initiation of physical force. Thus, it holds that the existence of such things as high capital requirements are a violation of freedom of competition and support of monopoly, but does not see as a violation of freedom of competition and the support of monopoly the forcible exclusion from markets of those who do possess the necessary capital and otherwise meet the requirements of reality. Precisely such forcible exclusion from markets is the essence of the operation of the antitrust laws. The most extreme form of monopoly imaginable is socialism. A socialist society represents monopoly carried to its ultimate limits. The government of such a society violently appropriates all the means of production and thereafter forcibly reserves the entire market of its country to its own exclusive possession. Whoever attempts to compete with it is automatically held to be guilty of the crimes of misappropriating state property and of sabotaging the national economic plan, since the means of production he must use have arbitrarily been declared to be the property of the state and to be required for use in the state's national economic plan. Concentration camps and firing squads are held in constant readiness to deter such competitors and protect the state's monopoly. Ironically, the existence of socialism serves to confirm the fact that monopoly is a political phenomenon, not an economic phenomenon. In direct refutation of the argument that the ownership of great wealth provides the power to crush all competitors and is thus the basis of monopolistic exploitation, the experience of socialism shows that the total 100% concentration of all wealth in the economic system in the hands of the socialist state is not sufficient to crush competition. The experience of socialism shows that in the absence of repressive laws designed to maintain its economic competition, the socialist economic monolith would quickly disintegrate in the face of growing competition from a mass of private entrepreneurs. In a further irony, the experience of socialism shows that it is not in the economic self-interest of anyone to seek to own the entire economic system. that it is to the self-interest of everyone that others own property which they are free to use independently. Socialism came to power in large part on the basis of the fear that capitalism would culminate in an economic monolith owning the entire world, and that socialism was necessary to operate the monolith for the benefit of the whole of mankind rather than just a handful of capitalists. The truth is that the development of such an economic monolith could never occur under capitalism. It would contradict the nature of the gains derived from the division of labor and its corollary, the division of knowledge. It would thus be against the self-interests of everyone, including even the handful of capitalists who are supposed to gain from it. It never remotely gets to any such point, because when firms make bad acquisitions, bad mergers that cut their profits, they later have to spin them off. The truth is that such a state of affairs, the formation of a world or nation embracing economic monolith, exists only under socialism. It is established and maintained by physical force. Nothing less than a communist revolution, which forcibly seizes all the means of production and places them in the hands of the state, is capable of accomplishing it, and nothing less than the continued existence of a thoroughly repressive regime is capable of maintaining it. What is going on today in the Soviet Union and throughout the communist world is precisely the growing realization that such an economic monolith is not in the interests even of those who are in charge of it. The great mass of members of the communist parties around the world, extending high up into the ranks of the various central committees of those parties, would all be more prosperous under capitalism than under socialism, even though they are the ones in charge of the communist monopoly. Finally, they have come to begin to understand this fact, and they are now seeking ways to dismantle socialism and establish capitalism. Turning now to another matter, I want to mention that in addition to the fact that monopoly can represent the protection of the inefficient many against the competition of the more efficient few, or even just one, it follows from much of our discussion that monopoly does not have any necessary connection with high profitability. There are, of course, instances of monopoly which can be associated with high profitability. Monopolies based on exclusive government franchises would be a leading case if they were not at the same time subjected to rate controls. Licensing monopolies are also cases in which profits tend to be artificially high. But the monopolies made possible by tariff protection, government subsidies, and the antitrust laws often do not result in any exceptional profitability on the part of the monopolists. And the monopolies based on minimum wage and pro-union legislation, of course, relate to wage income rather than profit income. These are cases in which monopoly is established primarily for the purpose of protecting high-cost producers. The same is often true in the case of licensing monopolies as well, and even in the case of monopolies based on exclusive government franchises. In many of these cases, the monopolists would be in the position of having to accept exceptionally low profits or even sustain losses in the absence of the government's help. In the case of government subsidies, they are unable to go on sustaining losses. Such monopolists turn to the government precisely because their profits would otherwise be exceptionally low or negative. The high monopoly prices that result in these cases serve as much or more to cover the monopolist's high costs due to inefficiency as to provide an exceptional rate of profit. And of course, in the case of government subsidized enterprises, the monopoly prices themselves may be extremely low or even zero. Now, before I conclude, I want to be sure to say that patents on new inventions, copyrights on books, drawings, musical compositions, and the like, and trademarks and brand names do not constitute monopolies. True enough, they reserve markets or parts of markets to the exclusive possession of the owners of the patents or copyrights or trademarks or brand names. And they do so by means of the use of physical force, because it's against the law to infringe on these rights. None of these rights represent monopoly, however, because none of them is supported by the initiation of physical force. In all of these cases, the government stands ready to use physical force in defense of a pre-existing property right established either by an act of personal creation or by the fact of personal identity. A new invention, a book, drawing, or song, and so forth, are specific products of a definite individual or group of individuals and belong to him or them on the same basis that a farmer's crop or a corporation's product belong to him or it, namely, the right of having created it, or by extension, having purchased it from its creator. A trademark or brand name belongs to its creator on the same basis as his own name, in order to distinguish the individual and his actions from all other individuals and their actions, and thus to be able to assign individual responsibility for the good or bad that one does. The fact that the government is ready to use force to protect patents and copyrights is fully as proper as that it stands ready to use force to protect farmers and businessmen in their ownership of their physical products and to come to their rescue when they are attacked by robbers or set upon by trespassers. In both cases, it does nothing more than protect the rights of producers to their products. In protecting trademarks and brand names, it does nothing more than when it protects individuals from impersonation by others. It acts to enable them to be recognized for the good or bad they do, and thus to gain or lose accordingly. The existence of patents and copyrights and trademarks and brand names, like all other protection of property rights, serves to increase the supply of goods and services by making it possible for those who are the cause of the increase to benefit from the improvements they make. It thus serves to reduce prices and to increase everyone's buying power as time goes on. It is true that at any given time, taking for granted the existence of the most recent batch of improvements, introduced in the expectation that those responsible would benefit from them, it might be possible to achieve a temporary acceleration in the supply of goods and services by abolishing patents, copyrights, trademarks, and brand names. Such a temporary acceleration in the supply of goods and services and reduction in their prices would be comparable in its ultimate significance to the abolition of the property rights of any other group of producers, such as storekeepers and manufacturers, and allowing mobs to sack their warehouses. A very short-lived gain would be followed by the permanent loss of future supplies, in this case, further new inventions and new ideas, which ultimately would cause not only the cessation of further economic progress, but actual economic decline, for reasons I've indicated in previous lectures here. Thus, contrary to monopoly, patents and copyrights and trademarks and brand names operate to increase supplies and reduce prices, while their abolition would result in the opposite. Indeed, their existence must be considered a requirement of the freedom of competition, and their abolition as constituting an establishment of monopoly. Their existence upholds the fundamental freedom of individuals to be secure in their property and to compete on that basis. Their abolition would reserve markets to the dull and incompetent by means of the initiation of force against those who had new ideas to offer. Their abolition would thus serve to establish the monopoly of the dull and incompetent. Because patents and copyrights protect intellectual property, their duration must necessarily be limited. It must be long enough to make it worthwhile to bring new products and new creations to the market, and yet not so long that the thinking of later generations is progressively hobbled by ever-growing royalty payments to the descendants of inventors and authors. I believe the basic principle was laid down in Ayn Rand's essay on patents and copyrights, and I agree with her that the present laws for patent and copyright protection are probably sufficient to strike just about the proper balance between the rights of the creators of today and those of the thinking men and women and the creators of the future. Well, by way of summary, I've shown that in the nature of the case, monopoly is based on government intervention, which restricts the freedom of competition. This morning, I discussed monopoly in its varied forms of licensing law monopoly, tariff monopoly, minimum wage and pro-union legislation, government-owned and government-subsidized enterprises, the antitrust laws, and socialism. I showed that the significance of monopoly is that it forcibly bars from the market sellers who would otherwise be capable of being in the market, and that it thus restricts the range of choice buyers have in suppliers and compels them to deal with less efficient suppliers and to accept higher costs and poorer quality than a free market would require them to accept. I showed how monopoly in the form of licensing laws is a principal cause of the growing crisis in medical care, and that to solve the crisis in medical care, it is essential to assert the rational right to medical care from willing providers, and thus to demand the abolition of all aspects of medical monopoly imposed by the government, which keeps people from dealing with willing providers of medical care. I showed how monopoly in the form of government-owned and government-subsidized enterprises retards economic progress and can destroy economic progress previously achieved, and that this is particularly true in the case of public education today. On the basis of what I have shown, the program of the enemies of monopoly should not be, as it has been for many years, the breakup of big business or the government's growing control over big business. Rather, it should be the dismantling of the welfare state and the progressive elimination of government intervention into the economic system. These are the things that violate the freedom of competition and constitute monopoly. Political progress should no longer be measured by the ever-increasing hobbling of competence and ability by the threat of physical force, but by the steady disappearance of the initiation of force, and thus the progressive opening up of the world to competence and ability. Such should be the pro-freedom, anti-monopoly politics of the future. It should stand alongside of and be an integral part of the advocacy of economic progress and an industrial society, which I urged in my first four lectures. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much. That's extremely gratifying. I can't quite see in the far rear. Yes. The question, does a country such as Sweden rely on the what of...
the states or Canada or some other freer country to support its own
Does a country such as Sweden, by which I'm assuming you're implying that Sweden is a socialist country, does Sweden, which the gentleman says is a socialist country, rely on the United States and other relatively capitalist countries to support it. That is true of the Soviet Union and all the communist countries, all the genuinely socialist countries. Sweden is not, in fact, a socialist country. The philosophy of the governing political party of Sweden is certainly a socialist philosophy, but that does not make the country itself socialist. The essential distinction from an economic point of view between a socialist and capitalist country is this. If production takes place at the initiative of private individuals motivated to make a profit and avoid losses, if that is what characterizes the productive activities of the economy, that it occurs under private initiative for private profit, then it is fundamentally a capitalist economy. And that is the case in Sweden today. That was the case even in Great Britain under the Labour Party. That is the case even in Israel under the Labour Party. In those countries, there is or was an enormous amount of government intervention, regulation. Here are people, they wish to make a profit. The government arbitrarily denies them many possible ways in which they might have made it. It compels them to do many things which they otherwise wouldn't have done. It taxes them heavily. But still, production is taking place at their initiative in order for them to make profit. A socialist economy, in contrast, is one in which production takes place under the orders, at the initiative, and under the plan of the government. In a socialist economy, production is not at the initiative of private individuals operating for private profit, but it takes place under the orders of the government. The only truly socialist countries in the world have been Soviet Russia, Communist China, the East European satellites, and in its day, Nazi Germany. In Nazi Germany, there was nominal private ownership, but the government told every business what prices it had to charge, what methods it had to use to produce, to whom to distribute its products. It made all of the economic decisions. That was de facto socialism. So this is an important point, not to confuse which countries are socialist. And for further reference, I refer you to my own book, The Government Against the Economy, and to von Mises' writings. Von Mises is the first one who really identified the critical distinction. Mr. Ballou.
Dr. Richter, you mentioned the division of its labor, and in your words, its corollary, the division of knowledge, which seems to give them equal status. I wonder if you could comment on that.
All right. The division of knowledge and division of labor. The division of labor means we each of us work and specialize doing one particular thing, the butcher, the baker, etc. The division of knowledge refers to the closely related fact that the total knowledge required to operate the economic system is held in relatively small parcels by an enormous number of separate individuals. Think of the fact that, for example, there is no one in this room or on this campus, there is no one person anywhere who knows how to produce this pen from scratch. Try to think of the knowledge you'd have to do that. You'd need to know mining, how to produce mining equipment. You'd need to know how to manufacture all the chemicals and so forth. It's one thing for a company to manufacture the pen, starting with buying the cartridges, the casings, various types of equipment. Within the company, it's very doubtful that anyone knows everything that it's doing. You have all kinds of separate job breakdowns. Different people know many different things. Now, the brilliance of a capitalist economy is that it operates on the foundation of enormous numbers of people, each knowing particular aspects of the productive process, and the entire thing is harmonized, integrated, coordinated by the price system. The problem of socialism is that for it to be operated successfully, it would require the services of an omniscient deity. And socialism has openly boasted that that would be its advantage without saying they really needed an omniscient deity, but that was the implication. The essential characteristic of socialism is supposed to be central planning. The socialists think that under capitalism we have anarchy because each individual goes off on his own self-interest, looking only at the facts that directly relate to him. Well, the Socialist Central Planning Board would see the big picture and operate for everybody. Well, the problem is, as I explained in The Government Against the Economy, for socialism to operate successfully, you'd have to have the head of the Central Planning Board and its members capable of holding in their brains an inventory of all of the factories, machines, farms, mines, their technological capabilities, and what could be done with them month by month, and project this for many years, and then they'd figure out what was the best permutation or combination, and that would be the central economic plan. Well, that's utterly impossible. We can only operate successfully with different individuals knowing relatively small parts of the picture, and it's harmonized and integrated on the basis of the price system and the profit motive. For further reference, please read The Government Against the Economy. Dr. Kirkpatrick. You mean the newer book? I have a book which is written, which contains all the material I've delivered in all the lectures at TJS, plus much more. It needs some editing. That's my major project from now on till it's done. So I'm hoping not too many months to be able to have something to hand in to a publisher. But it is very, very large, and it's a project just to, if you want the thing to be consistent between chapter 2 and chapter 20, it gets to be massive. So it's not easy to edit, but I'm working on it. Thank you for asking. Yes. Could I comment on the voucher plan for education? This would be a plan whereby, instead of simply having public schools, the government, in effect, would give people a voucher that it would redeem for money, and then they present the voucher at the school of their choice. I would say that this seems like a significant improvement over the present system. I have a few mental reservations about it. I don't think it could be any worse. But what your question does suggest in connection with public education, you know, people believe public education is necessary because there are poor children who otherwise could not be educated. And that's the problem they want to redress. Now, let us grant this is a legitimate problem. We'd like to see poor children obtain an education. Now, even if we were to make a concession that the government might have to do something to help, even if one conceded that, which I'm not, but if one did, it would not follow that you require public education. There are poor children whose diets are inadequate. That doesn't mean that the government has to own grocery stores and restaurants. We should have private education if there is, for some time, still to be some government involvement. The government should somehow enable those who otherwise couldn't buy the education to buy it. It's not necessary that the government own public schools. So I think the voucher system could be viewed as a movement toward having private education, and if there are no further hidden problems, that it would be an improvement. Yeah?
Would you recommend the model to use other
government? Would I
recommend model to use and take advantage of other being used by government?
Would I, from a moral perspective, recommend people using products that are financed by taxes? Well, you see, I don't see how it can be avoided. I'm not advocating as moral that the government collect taxes by force. And I'm doing everything within my power to work against that. But if you look at the implications of what you're saying, if you apply it, there is no one who provides roads or highways than the government. If you're not going to use products provided on that foundation, that means you can't drive on roads or highways. You see, when you do have a choice, well, it would depend on what is the imposition on you. I think the principle here is found in another essay of Ayn Rand's on scholarships, government scholarships. Should a student accept a government scholarship? And it would apply to any government benefit. Well, if you are not advocating the system, if you are opposing the underlying system, you are not morally responsible for the existence of that system. Your rejection of whatever limited advantage it might be to you in that context is not going to do anything against the system. It will only operate against you. And then someone else who supports the system will go to school or whatever. And so her recommendation in the context is that one accept such a benefit, but fight against the underlying system. I can't see any other reasonable course of action. So you should be take it, but fight against the continuation of the existence of it. Yes, this gentleman right here.
5 minutes ago, you mentioned that socialism is one word because the producers would have, the estates would have to know the facts about all factors of production and all the goods available.
Yeah.
Isn't another piece of knowledge that they wouldn't have is the knowledge knowledge of how each person values the goods that are in society. As Egon pointed out in the chapter on productiveness, he said that a value is not a value unless people recognize it to be such. And a socialist status could not know how each person holds the values that are in society.
All right, the gentleman raises as another objection to socialism that it could not know the values of the citizens, and therefore it wouldn't produce for their benefit. Now, that is perfectly true, but I think you should realize that the leaders of a socialist society don't really care about the values of the citizens. And from their perspective, the citizens are simply means to their ends. And they are, in fact, in the position of the they're genuine exploiters. They do not voluntarily give to the citizens more than is required to keep them from revolting, if they can afford to provide that much. The citizens have no economic power. Again, I won't elaborate this here. I refer you to chapter 7 of The Government Against the Economy. Yes, this gentleman right here.
I understood you to say that the quality of products produced or services produced by the government would have to go to zero before they were rejected.
Well, they don't have to go all the way to zero, but to lose the mass market, they have to get pretty close. And this is on the point of happening perhaps in public education today. You see, it depends on how wealthy the members of the market are. If you look at the case of automobiles, someone is willing to pay $50,000 for a Mercedes rather than $20,000 for a Lincoln, perhaps, because he thinks the incremental difference is worth $30,000. Now, there are parents who could send their children to public school for nothing, but who would consider it's worth $30,000 to send them to private school for the difference. Now, as the differences become more and more pronounced, if the wheels are falling off the Lincoln and the Mercedes is still maintaining itself, then more people become willing. And if public education reaches a state of total collapse, then either your child isn't educated or you find a way to send them to private school. Now, I have a written question that someone gave me, which I'd like to try to briefly address. 10 minutes, thank you. How does the theory of monopoly apply to airfares in cities that are hubs, that is, hubs for only one or two airlines? If you have the freedom of competition, if it is legally possible for others to open competing means of transportation, competing airlines, then these things are not monopolies. Their rates have to be in line with the costs of providing a comparable service by other producers. They cannot exceed the prices that would make it profitable for those who are not presently providing such a service to do so. Now, the case of hubs is often raised. Suppose you have, I guess Dallas is the hub of American Airlines. Now, if there's a free market, and if for some reason, because American has most of the gates in Dallas, if some reason it costs more to travel out of Dallas to go comparable distances than it did to travel out of other cities, and there was no foundation for it, then I think you would have some additional outside competition. And the rates would be limited. Yes?
Not monopoly with regard to airlines, but monopoly with regard to airports and the landing slots. But the question I wanted to ask was, could you apply this to the banking industry here?
Okay, can I apply this to the banking industry? But first, let me just follow up on your observation. We don't have privately owned airports as a rule. They are generally provided by some kind of government authority. And the government severely limits the ability to establish a competing airport. So it is possible that you can have a genuine element of monopoly in air travel where the government stops people from providing alternative means of transportation that they otherwise might provide. Okay, now you're asking me to apply this to monopoly, and I'll have to ask you to amplify on this.
Monopoly analysis to the banking industry.
How would I apply my monopoly analysis to the banking industry? Well, I would say that there should be full legal freedom of entry for anyone to establish a bank. The government should not be able to impose any kind of restrictions on your being able to do so. Yes?
Would you say that the phrase protective tariffs is redundant, or is there another type of tariff?
Well, there's a distinction made between two types of tariff, a protective tariff and a revenue tariff. And the intent of the two is very different. A protective tariff seeks at excluding foreign producers. And from the perspective of the objective of a protective tariff, you'd want it so high that no foreign producer would be able to sell his goods profitably, and he just wouldn't sell. From the perspective of a revenue tariff, the government wants to maximize the tax collections that it has, and that will typically be realized by the largest possible volume of imports. So a revenue tariff would generally be a very modest tariff, not serving as a serious impediment to importation, and by virtue of its volume would provide the government with a high revenue. Yes?
What would you say is the primary reason that Japanese producers seem to be so much more effective today relative to the American producers? I mean, I hear these explanations such as those government subsidies and so forth.
You're asking why are the Japanese producers so much more efficient than we are, and you hear as a typical explanation that they get government subsidies? Okay, now I have a feeling that this came up in another lecture period, but I'll be glad to go over this. It's, you have some added elements in there. I think there are several reasons for Japan's much better performance. One of them has to do with the vastly higher rate of saving in Japan than in the United States. The higher is the rate of saving in a country, the effect of that is that the greater is its concentration on increasing its further ability to produce. You start off, you have a limited ability to produce. The more that is saved, the greater will be the demand for capital goods relative to consumer goods. The greater will be the portion of output that takes the form of new factories, improved machines, and so forth, which enables you to produce more the next year. Now, the Japanese have had this much higher concentration on saving and capital goods than we have had for several decades. And the foundation of this is a much lower level of government spending and taxation in Japan. To take as an indication of this is, in the United States, government spending at all levels is equal to roughly 40% of the so-called gross national product. In Japan, it has been in the neighborhood of 25 or 26%. And much of that difference represents Japan uses most of that difference to concentrate on capital goods. And you cannot account for most of this difference on the basis of our higher national defense establishment. About 6% of the United States national defense cost is about 6% of the gross national product. Japanese national defense is about 1%. So that accounts for 5 out of the difference of 15%. The big difference is that Japan has a much, much smaller welfare state. They only started Social Security in 1959. It's on a much more modest scale. Their tax system lands much less heavily on the kinds of incomes that people save and invest. That's one very important factor. Another is the major difference in connection with labor unions. In the United States, the leading industries are subject to chronic industrial sabotage, not of a private, of a directly criminal nature, but they're constantly restricted. They're constantly prevented from adopting improvements they otherwise could adopt by virtue of being compelled to deal with labor unions that believe that fighting the improvements is the way to hold on to their jobs. The whole product quality problem is largely an issue of the government supporting labor unions in the United States. You've all heard of the phenomenon of the Monday morning automobiles. You shouldn't buy an American car produced on a Monday. Why? Because too many of the workers are hungover from the weekend, or not enough of them are there. Now you might wonder, why is that the case? Why doesn't the company just fire those workers and replace them? Well, they're prevented by having to deal with the labor unions. And then a third factor is the difference in antitrust legislation. In the United States, evidently a significant amount of research and development is prevented because if companies were undertaking it jointly, they would be held in violation of the antitrust laws. That is not so in Japan. Finally, we have a greater collapse of the educational system here. Their educational system is still imparting serious knowledge. Ours has largely stopped doing so. Finally, this notion about subsidies, that is all in the eyes of the fascist or socialist commentator who could not understand any other basis for economic progress but government intervention. So you can find isolated cases where the Japanese government has provided some subsidies. But it is absurd to believe that such cases have any real significance at all. In 1950, Japan was a totally impoverished country. There was absolutely nothing that the Japanese government could have done to finance the Japanese economy. Contrary to what many people believe, the government is not God in heaven who rescues industries and builds economies. What the government has always is a derivative, a byproduct of what the people can produce. Japan grew by virtue of starting out with very little, doing the best they could with what they had, saving a huge chunk of it, which made them more productive the next year. Out of the larger output of the next year, they again saved a big chunk of that, which made them still more productive the year after. And by a process of improvement step by step over many years, they grew. The basis of Japan's success is the profit motive of its firms, the success of its firms in introducing newer, better products, more efficient methods of production, and constantly saving and reinvesting the greater part of the profits. We could duplicate their success. In fact, they're duplicating our previous success. What we have to do is not have subsidies. If you have subsidies, you're taking the profits of the more efficient firms who have the knowledge and the motive to use them efficiently when they reinvest and giving them to the less efficient who won't be able to expand the economy as much or contract it. Our decline is the result in large part of government subsidies and certainly of government interference. Their success is the result of a freer policy. We are now out of time. Well, thank you very, very much.